Basic rice beer. The generic process for rice beer is extremely simple. Cook rice. Cool. Add starter culture. Ferment. Strain. Drink. I love the simplicity of how I first tried it, even after surveying dozens of recipes and trying a handful of variations. I used short grain brown rice, which I did not even pre-soak, and cooked as I typically do, though without salt. Figure about 2 pounds, 4 cups, / 1 kilograms, 1 liter, of dry rice and 1 small chew yeast ball make about 3 quarts / liters of rice beer. After cooking, allow the rice to cool to body temperature. As it cools, crush a yeast ball into powder. If you do not have a mortar and pestle, press with the back of a spoon against a sturdy bowl. Use 1 yeast ball per kilogram, 2 pounds, of rice. Some recipes use even less, and more can speed the process. As the rice cools, transfer it to a crock or other vessel. Once it reaches body temperature, add the powdered yeast ball. I clean my hands and get in there, squeezing clumps and getting it all thoroughly mixed. I suppose you could also do it with a spoon. After the starter is well distributed in the rice, use a spoon to form a well in the center of the rice. As the fermentation proceeds and liquefaction occurs, this well fills with fluid. Rice beer. Incubate in a warm spot. Most of the year, I use the oven, turned off, with the illumination light on. In summer, ambient temperatures are perfect. After liquefied rice fills the well, the bubbling liquid will cover the rice, but the bubbling will also lift the rice above the liquid. Stir several times a day at this stage. Rice beer is quite delicious throughout its development and strongly alcoholic after about a week. Strain off the liquid and enjoy cloudy, or allow the starch to settle and pour off the clarified beer. Refrigerate for short-term preservation or pasteurize for longer-term storage. Otherwise, lactic acid bacteria from the mixed culture will continue to acidify it. Surveying recipes in books and online, there is much variation and cultural particularity in all the details of this process, as it is practiced by many of the billions of people sprawled across the vast continent of Asia in thousands of distinctive cultural lineages. They may be clarified into liquid or turbidly suspended liquid, even they may be semi-solid unfiltered mash, explain Su Gan Rong and Bao Tong Fa of Jiangnan University in Jiangsu Province, China, in their online Grandiose Survey of Chinese Alcoholic Drinks and Beverages. Dr. S. Sikar of Bharathidasan University in Tamil Nadu, India, in his Database on Microbial Traditional Knowledge of India, details methods for 19 different rice beers, as well as the varied starters used to ferment them. Here's the process for one of them, called Ruhi, from Nagaland, in India's northeastern hills. Boiled rice is spread on mat and allowed to cool. It is mixed with yeast grown on rice and nosan leaves. The inoculated rice is poured into cone-shaped bamboo basket. An earthenware pot is placed under the cone to collect the fermented liquid. The liquid is transferred to new boiled rice successively for 3 or 4 times. The liquid finally collected becomes the first quality ruhi. Some recipes online are very specific as to type of rice. I think this is because so many different varieties of rice are important in different places, and these distinctive rices give beverages fermented from them distinctive qualities. But in my lackadaisical way, I have more often than not used the wrong type of rice in my rice brew experiments, and I've ended up using quite a few different varieties, sticky and not, brown and white and black, and somehow it's always good, though not necessarily authentic to any particular tradition. Some recipes say to boil rice, others say to steam it above water. I've tried both ways, and both work. As for the starter, in some traditions the crushed, dried yeast is soaked in water to bring it back to life and activate it. Other traditions mix crushed starter dry into rice, as I described above. Also, in some traditions no water is added, so the microbial and enzymatic starters begin their activity in an aerobic environment, until the liquefaction they cause engulfs them. In others, fermentation takes place entirely in a liquid medium, with water added immediately to the cooked rice. In some traditions, including Japanese sake, rice is introduced into the fermentation gradually, at repeated intervals, enabling yeasts to produce alcohol at unusually high concentrations, up to 20%, much stronger than any other type of fermented alcohol. In different traditions, different temperatures are deemed to be ideal. For sake, rice is fermented in a cool environment, around 60 degrees Fahrenheit or 15 degrees Celsius, for several weeks. In many other traditions, rice is fermented in a warm environment, around 90 degrees Fahrenheit or 32 degrees Celsius, for about a week, then sometimes finished in a cooler spot. Elsewhere, people work with ambient temperatures. Typically, rice brews are strained before drinking to remove residual solids and yeast sediment. This sediment, equivalent to what the Japanese call sake lees, may be used as pickling medium or as an ingredient in pancakes and other concoctions, or fed to animals or compost. After straining, the liquid may be left to settle and be further clarified by gently pouring the clear liquor on top off the starchy suspension that sinks. But rice beer is not necessarily even strained. A fermentation enthusiast named Mick recounted, "I was once walking through some farmland out in the middle of China somewhere with some friends, and we stopped at a farmhouse where they served us food and bowls of alcoholic rice. Not rice wine, but the actual fermented rice that would be strained for the wine. Very strong stuff." The brew with rice still in it is often used as the basis of soups and other culinary creations. A blogger wrote that, "In my family, we use rice wine most often to flavor soft poached eggs, also known as jiunyangdan. It is prepared by poaching eggs in simmering water until the whites are firm but the yolks are still somewhat runny. The eggs are placed into single-serving bowls with a small teaspoonful of sugar and a quantity of the hot water. Several tablespoonfuls of the jiunyang rice and wine are added to the bowl and stirred so that the rice warms up and the sugar melts. In another version I read about, water is boiled, rice wine and sugar are added, then scrambled eggs are mixed in, for more of an egg drop soup rather than poached egg feel. Either way, it is very delicious, even without the sugar." Next are further explorations of three specific variants on the basic rice beer theme. Korean makgeolli, in which the rice is supplemented by sweet potato as a fermentation substrate, Nepali tungba, made from millet, and Japanese sake. Sweet potato makgeolli. Makgeolli is a Korean rice beer. I first heard about it from Linda Kim of New York City, who emailed me recounting her experience making some. It's very simple and only takes around 3 to 5 days to ferment. I liked the sound of that. Linda told me she had found the Korean starter culture called Nuruk online. When I searched online for Nuruk, I found nothing. Then Linda sent me a link to a Korean-owned grocery chain and website, which sells Nuruk as powdered enzyme amylase, and I bought some for $5. My internet searching turned up a number of makgeolli recipes, the most interesting being one from a blog called Soulful Cooking that incorporates sweet potatoes, one of my favorite foods. The makgeolli process is one in which I adapted elements from Linda Kim's emails, the Soulful Cooking blog, and other online recipes. To make makgeolli, rinse 2 pounds or 1 kilogram sweet rice and soak overnight, or all day. Drain well, then steam the rice. I like to steam in stacking bamboo steamers, available in most Asian markets, lined with a cotton cloth to keep the grains from falling through the bottom. Once the rice is well cooked, spread it onto a tray or cookie sheet to cool. Meanwhile, scrub 1/2 pound or 250 grams sweet potatoes, chop into big chunks with the skins on, steam until soft, and then cool. When the rice is cool enough to handle, transfer it to a crock, bowl, or jar with a capacity of at least 1 gallon or 4 liters. Add about 2 quarts or liters of dechlorinated water. Use your hands to gently squeeze rice, separating individual grains. Add crushed Nuruk and massage it into the mass. Add sweet potatoes, skins and all, and crush them with your hands as you mix them into the mass. Cover with a cloth and leave in a warm spot. After a few hours and at least twice a day thereafter, stir the rice sweet potato Nuruk mass to help redistribute and spread enzyme and yeast activity. At first, all the water you added is absorbed by the rice. But as enzymatic digestion progresses, liquefaction occurs gradually, and the mass is soon floating in liquid. After a couple of days, replace the cloth covering vessel with a firmer, less permeable top that will restrict airflow. Ferment until most of the rice grains have sunk to the bottom. This may take just a few days in a warm environment or as long as 2 weeks in a cool one. Strain and transfer to bottles. Leave bottles at ambient temperature for another day to carbonate if desired. Store makgeolli in the fridge for a couple of weeks, but note that it will slowly acidify unless pasteurized. Many people add sugar to sweeten makgeolli when they drink it, but personally, I don't think it's necessary. Millet tungba. Tungba is a millet beer made in the style of rice beers using a traditional mixed culture starter. I first heard about Tungba from my friend Victory, who had fond memories of it from his travels in Nepal. The fermented grain was served in a tall glass with a thermos of hot water and a straw on which the bottom was covered with a piece of cotton tied on to filter the grain. One tall glass was good for 5 or 6 water refills. After the second glass, laughter seemed to follow all the imbibers for the rest of the evening until we all staggered home. It tasted like liquid bread. Actually, it turns out that Tungba, also transliterated as Tungba, is the name of the bamboo vessel in which this beverage, Kodo Kojanya, is traditionally served. According to Jyoti Prakash Tamang's book, Himalayan Fermented Foods, a Tungba is a vessel in which fermented millet seeds are placed and warm water is added. The extract is sipped through a narrow bamboo straw with a hole on opposite sides at one end of the straw to avoid passing of grits during sipping. I love this strong and distinctive brew, warm and milky, and also the fun ritual that goes with it. To consume, fill a mug about halfway with fermented millet mush, then fill it the rest of the way with hot water. I let it sit for 10 minutes, then drink it warm, and repeat. For me, 2 or 3 pours or pressings are plenty. I've mostly sipped the liquid off the grains without a straw, filtering with my teeth as needed, but it was fun to drink it through a bombilla, one of those steel straws used for drinking yerba mate. You can also filter it through a strainer. The millet used in Nepal, Kodo millet, Paspalum scorbiculatum, is somewhat different from the millet grown in the United States, pearl millet, Penicetum americanum. But I love the Tungba that the pearl millet produces. It so happened that my friend, Justin Bullard, who lived in Nepal long ago and learned to make Tungba and Chang there, was returning to Nepal to document methods for making the Nepali starter, Marcha, and he brought some Marcha home for me, so I had a supply of the authentic starter. I have not been able to locate any internet sources for purchasing Marcha, but Chinese yeast balls can substitute for it with similar results. First, prepare millet. I use a proportion of about 2 1/2 volumes water to each volume millet. Bring to a boil, then gently simmer, covered for about 15 minutes until the seeds burst open, then remove from the heat. Justin instructed me to add a little cold water to the millet, so the water just covers the cooked millet. As soon as it is cool enough to handle, use your clean hands to massage the millet and break up clumps, so every grain is individual in the solution. When the millet is below body temperature, add crushed marcha or Chinese yeast balls and mix thoroughly to distribute. I followed Justin's recommendation of 2 cakes of marcha per pound of millet. With Chinese yeast balls, 1 per pound would be plenty. Half that would probably suffice. Justin writes, "Let it ferment at least until the mash stops bubbling. The mash will keep for about a season, but is best used, I think, after about a month of fermentation." Jyoti Prakash Tamang, author of Himalayan Fermented Foods, Microbiology, Nutrition, and Ethnic Values, describes a shorter process, 5 to 10 days altogether. I loved it at 1 week. It was strongly alcoholic, no longer sweet, and only subtly sour. What we didn't drink in the first episode remained in the crock for a few more days, then after I noticed that bubbling had ceased, I transferred it to a sealed jar, where I left it for another couple of weeks. When I tasted it again, the Tungba had gotten stronger, both more alcoholic and more sour. Had I transferred it to a sealed jar earlier, as soon as bubbling slowed, I probably could have avoided some of the sourness. Sake. As described earlier, Japanese sake is the fermented rice beverage that has become best known beyond its homeland. People who eat sushi or dine in Japanese restaurants often enjoy sake, smooth, strong, and often served warm. Koji, the Japanese molded grain, covered at length in Chapter 10, is the starter for sake. Or rather, it is part of the starter. Koji is the product of rice's inoculation with the spores of a single mold, Aspergillus oryzae. The enzymes in this mold accomplish the saccharification of the rice necessary to ferment it to alcohol, and many other fermentations. However, koji does not contain the yeast that actually accomplish the alcohol fermentation, as do Chinese yeast balls, nuruk, marcha, and all the other mixed culture starters that incorporate aspergillus and other molds, as well as yeasts and bacteria. Most contemporary sake makers add specialized, commercially available, single-species yeast starters, a tradition going back more than 100 years in Japan. There is also, of course, an older wild fermentation tradition. One notable requirement of sake making is cool temperatures, as low as 45 degrees Fahrenheit, or 7 degrees Celsius, and definitely below 60 degrees Fahrenheit, or 15 degrees Celsius. My experiments have been in winter, in a room that could be shut off from heat. You could use a wine refrigerator, or any fridge rigged up with an overriding temperature controller. The first step of the sake making process is making or purchasing koji. A small amount of koji is mixed with water, freshly steamed rice, and typically a yeast starter. This is the moto, or shubo, and it bubbles for a few days in a warm environment, 70 to 73 degrees Fahrenheit or 21 to 23 degrees Celsius. This gets the yeast active before adding the bulk of the rice, but it also has traditionally served the purpose of allowing lactic acid to develop, which, when present in sufficient amounts, prevents wild yeast and unwanted bacteria from proliferating and adversely affecting the flavor, according to John Gauntner, author of several books on sake. Early in the 20th century, it was determined that lactic acid could be added directly at the start of the process. Adding lactic acid at the beginning speeds the process up and protects it from the start. This practice, by which most sake is now prepared, is known as sokujo, fast developing, moto. The traditional process takes much longer, and since the lactic acid comes into existence more slowly, a bit of funky bacteria and even wild yeast cells inevitably make it into the moto as it develops. This gives rise to gamier, more unabashed flavor profile in the end. I made a batch of sake using sourdough starter as the source of yeast and lactic acid bacteria, and it had an unabashed flavor profile for sure. Once the moto is mature, you make three successively larger additions of rice, koji, and water, roughly doubling the size of the batch with each addition. Each addition has its own name in this highly formalized process. The first is hatsuzo. Koji and water are added in the evening, then the next morning more rice is added. For 2 days, this is known as the odori, dancing, ferment, until you incorporate the second nakazoe addition of twice as much koji, twice as much water, and the following morning, twice as much rice. Then a day later, twice as much of each element yet again for the final tomezoe addition. Once all the rice has been incorporated, the rice mash is known as moromi, and it ferments for 2 weeks. After this fermentation, sake is usually strained and pressed to separate the fermented liquid from the solid residue, lees. Sake can be enjoyed at this point or transferred to an air-locked vessel until all bubbling ceases, a week or two later. At this point, sake may be filtered and clarified to remove its white, cloudy, suspended starches if desired. Personally, I love it cloudy, with some body. Sake is typically pasteurized in the bottle so it will not continue to acidify. Namazake is unpasteurized sake, which is very lovely, but must be stored under refrigeration or drunk quickly. Sour sake is not a bad thing to end up with. I love it as a steaming liquid in cooking and enjoy little shots of it as a tonic rich in lactic acid bacteria. Sake in our time is generally made from polished rice, meaning rice that has been milled to remove the outer layers. The problem with this is the same as the problem with eating refined grains. The outer layers contain critical nutrients. Therefore, most sake recipes call for the addition of various minerals and yeast nutrients. If you use brown rice, you don't have to add any other kinds of chemical foods for the yeast to grow, points out traveling fermentation experimentalist Eric Haas. Eric wrote to me from Japan, "I found few people who make their own sake, but some people who make amazing stuff." He cited one sake maker in particular whose sake was thick and cloudy, nigori, raw, nama, and dreamy like a cloud. The best I've ever had. According to Eric, the man grew his own rice, made it into koji, and never introduced any commercial yeasts, relying upon wild fermentation and using especially good batches as starters. Malting barley. Finally, we arrive at our familiar beer, the beverage fermented from malted barley, with hops added for flavoring and preservation. Malting is the first step of this process. Beer makers have largely relegated the malting of barley to specialists. I have been able to find only one small-scale brewery that has an in-house malting operation, Rogue Brewery in Newport, Oregon, as well as a small handful of obsessed homebrewers who make beer from barley they malt themselves. Sprouting barley is no harder than sprouting any other grain, but malting has developed as an art and science with much technique and technology to help achieve optimal enzyme development. Although malting historically was regarded as part of the brewing process, as the scale of breweries grew and specialization increased in every realm of industrial production, malting operations mostly split off from breweries, and local and regional malt houses supplied malt to multiple breweries. By the late 20th century, malting became highly centralized. A 1998 analysis found that in the United States and Canada, 8 firms control 97% of malt production. An otherwise informative book explaining the science behind brewing beer, Brewchem 101, devotes exactly one sentence to malting. Since it's the rare home brewer indeed who germinates his or her own grains, we won't say anything more about it. But malting is an integral part of the process of making beer, and malting your own grain will definitely enhance your understanding of the process by which grains become beer. Specialization may be warranted, given the technical challenges of malting. However, homemade malt can make perfectly fine beer, which does not require enzyme optimization. And even malting specialization does not have to result in centralized industry, just as grain itself need not be monocultured in remote regions. In the local food revival of the past decade, a few regional relocalizing maltsters have started operations. Grain growing is also occurring as part of the revival of local food and agricultural diversification. These emerging movements promise to redefine our understanding of how local a beer can be. To malt barley, be sure to start with whole, unhulled barley, complete with outer husk. It is best to malt barley at a moderately cool temperature around 55 to 60 degrees Fahrenheit, or 13 to 16 degrees Celsius. The barley should not be too freshly harvested. Most sources recommend storing barley for a minimum of 6 weeks before germinating. Cover barley with water and stir. Chaff will float to the surface. You'll want to pour off the chaff. Cover the barley with more water if necessary and soak about 8 hours. After this soak, drain the water off and allow the barley to sit with air circulation for another 8-hour period. Then cover with water again and soak for another 8 hours. This is interrupted steeping, in which steeping is broken up by air rests to give the germinating grain access to oxygen. After draining barley from the second soaking, you should start to see white bulges at one end of each grain. These are emergent roots. Give barley another longer air rest of 12 to 16 hours, then a third 8-hour steeping. Steeping schedules vary depending on parameters such as variety, kernel size, protein content, and physiological status of the grain, explains Charles Bamforth, author of the definitive Scientific Principles of Malting and Brewing. The jar method I recommend for sprouting in Chapter 8 is not appropriate for quantities above a pound or two of grain. Traditionally, steeped barley was spread out to a depth of up to 10 centimeters, 4 inches, on the floors of long, low buildings and germinated for up to 10 days, writes Bamforth. Workers would use rakes either to thin out the grain or pile it up, depending on whether the temperature of the batch needed to be lowered or raised. I've seen people malt barley for brewing in 5-gallon, 20-liter, buckets with holes in the bottom for drainage and air circulation, and in tubs on the floor. German home brewer Axel Gellert, who wrote to me describing his malting experiments, used his Lautertun, a tool home brewers use to filter solids from the wort, as a malting vessel. The key requirements are that the grains must have access to oxygen, but must also remain moist and not dry out. Turning the grain frequently so different grains are exposed to air helps keep germination even. Lightly misting the grain with dechlorinated water can prevent it from drying out. As germination proceeds, the emerging roots grow, as does the sprout itself. Although for most of the process, the sprout is hidden by the hulls. The key factor is to stop germination when the main shoot, not the hair-like rootlets, called the acrospire, is 3/4 to 1 length of the grain, writes William Starr Moak in Brew Your Own magazine. This produces fully modified barley malt. From initial soaking, this takes about a week, though the exact time will vary with grain variety, temperature, humidity, and other conditions. Once malt is germinated sufficiently, the process is halted by drying with heat, usually in a low-temperature oven or kiln. If germination were to continue, the developing embryo would consume the barley seed's newly available sugars. Kilning not only stops germination, but also alters the flavor of the sprouts. In the words of Charles Bamforth, kilning is a driving off of the undesirable raw flavors in the green malt, notes reminiscent of bean sprouts and cucumber, nice in their own right, but not as a component of beer, while introducing the pleasing malty flavors. Kilning temperatures vary greatly to produce different styles of malt with different purposes. High-enzyme diastatic malts, for instance, are kilned at temperatures that typically do not exceed 131 degrees Fahrenheit or 55 degrees Celsius to avoid destruction of the enzymes by heat, explains Bamforth. Other specialty malts can be kilned at temperatures as high as 428 degrees Fahrenheit or 220 degrees Celsius, produced not for their enzyme content but rather for use by the brewer in relatively small quantities as a source of extra color and distinct types of flavor. Generally, kilning begins at temperatures around 120 degrees Fahrenheit or 50 degrees Celsius and slowly increases. For small quantities, you can work with your oven with a light on, or the pilot light, or turning the very lowest setting on and off. Simple opaque barley beer. I decided to try barley beer in the style of indigenous porridge and malt beers, like sorghum beer. I malted a pound of unhulled barley. Then I coarsely ground some unmalted pearled barley and cooked it into a porridge. This I cooled to 140 degrees Fahrenheit or 60 degrees Celsius in an insulated cooler, simultaneously warming the cooler to serve as an incubation chamber. When the porridge cooled, I added half of the malted barley, coarsely ground, and left it to incubate in the pre-warmed cooler. After several hours, I removed the still warm and now enzyme-sweetened porridge from the incubator and let it cool to about 110 degrees Fahrenheit, or 43 degrees Celsius. Next, I added half the remaining malted barley and let it sit to sour for about 12 hours. This was the heat of summer. 24 hours would be the timing otherwise. Then I cooked the brew for a couple of hours, stirring periodically and adding water as necessary, and once again let it cool, this time to ambient temperatures. Finally, I added the last of the malt to introduce yeast and stirred the fermenting mash as it bubbled away. I fermented it for about a week, stirring frequently. Fermentation bubbles kept lifting the barley solids, so stirring would mix them back into the fermenting solution, at least temporarily, until the vigorous bubbles lifted them again. After about a week, as bubbling activity slowed significantly, I strained the beer through cheesecloth, then poured a little more water through it, and finally wrung out the ball of spent grain in the cheesecloth, squeezing out as much liquid as I could. The beer was pretty strong. It was also somewhat sour, as is the intention and inevitability in this style of brew. I found this to be a worthwhile exercise that helped me see and taste the lineage between the indigenous brews with other grains and the beer with which we are more familiar. Interestingly, Hamid Dirar reports that Marissa, the Sudanese sorghum beer, is also known as Boza, which, according to food historian Priscilla Mary Isin, is an ancient Turkish name for beer that can be traced back to the Sumerians, has found its way into more than 20 languages in Central Asia, Eastern Europe, and North Africa, and probably gives us the English word booze. Cassava and potato beers. Cassava is made into beer in several different ways. In Amazon, South America, as well as parts of Africa, women chew cassava as the saccharification step of a fermented beverage called masato. A team of anthropologists reported the preparation of masato as follows. First, cassava is boiled and allowed to cool in a wooden container. One woman continues beating the mass until it is smooth, while other women chew to insalivate it. Some families prefer to use sugar to affect fermentation, thus avoiding the chewing. When reduced to a watery consistency, the mass is placed into clay jars to ferment. After 3 or 4 days, it is mixed with water and offered in cups to visitors. Interestingly, elsewhere in South America, in Guyana, people use molds to achieve the same goal of saccharification of cassava to ferment into alcohol, in this case a beverage called paracari. Paracari is unique among New World beverages because it involves the use of an amylolytic mold, rhizopus, followed by a solid substratum ethanol fermentation, according to mycologist Terry Henkel, who documented the method he saw used in Guyana, very similar to how molds are used and perpetuated throughout Asia. The domestication of rhizopus in South America appears independent from, yet analogous to, ancient rhizopus domestications in Asia, writes Henkel. As I pondered trying these with cassava, available in nearby cities but imported from the tropics somewhere, Just as I was harvesting potatoes, I decided to try these with the starchy tubers from my garden. Other than adding potatoes or potato starch as a minor ingredient in a barley-based beer or sugar-based country wine, I have not been able to find any information on traditional potato-based fermented beverages. Chewed potato beer. With the kind assistance of a workshop group, I made a chewed potato beer. I wouldn't say it was great, but it was definitely alcoholic after just 24 hours fermentation, with a flavor that was tolerable and interesting, though not altogether appealing. Lots of people enjoyed a taste. Only one person, Hannah, drank a big mugful. This is the process I followed. I offer this not so much as a recipe as a point of departure for adventuring experimentalists. First, boil whole potatoes until they are soft, then drain them and allow them to cool. The way to chew the potatoes is to take a bite and mash it thoroughly for a moment with your teeth and also between your tongue and the roof of your mouth. You want to form little mashed potato balls, pretty finely mashed, moistened by your saliva, but not too much. They have to be dry enough to hold together and not collapse into puddles. Do this in a group. You might be surprised how filling it can be chewing potatoes and then spitting them out. Each person can only do so many. You can work with the mashed potato balls fresh, refrigerate, or dry in the sun or a dehydrator for longer-term storage. In a pot, boil a little water with a few more, not chewed, potatoes, coarsely chopped. The enzyme-infused potatoes have enough salivary enzymes to convert starch in more potatoes. After the potatoes are soft, mash them up in the water. Then add cold water, a little at a time, and mash it in, until the thin potato gruel cools to below 150 degrees Fahrenheit, or 65 degrees Celsius. Then add the mashed potato spitballs to the gruel and gently heat, stirring frequently until the expanded mass of gruel heats to above 140 degrees Fahrenheit, or 60 degrees Celsius. This very warm temperature stimulates the amylase enzymes in the saliva to be at their most vigorously active. Hold the temperature in this range for an hour or two. The lowest setting on a stove should work fine with periodic stirring. Or you could use a pre-warmed insulated cooler or an incubator. After you hold the temperature a while, leave it to slowly cool. Once the potato gruel has cooled to ambient temperatures, heat it again, this time to a boil, and gently boil it for a couple of hours. This stops enzyme activity, kills salivary bacteria that may be of concern, and caramelizes newly converted sugars. After boiling, remove the potato gruel from the heat and allow it to cool to ambient temperatures. I wanted to ferment this quickly so the group that chewed it could taste it, so I added a packet of yeast. Alternatively, you could add a vigorous sourdough or berries as a starter at this point. I also added fresh leaves of sage as a flavoring. Once the fermentation began, it developed and peaked very quickly. I cooked the gruel in the evening. In the morning, I pitched it with yeast. By mid-afternoon, fermentation was highly active, with bubbles forcing the potato solids to float at the top, where they could easily be scooped off, and by the following morning, fermentation had stopped and the liquid was still. I strained off the remaining potato solids and bottled the beer, left the bottles at ambient temperatures for another 24 hours to carbonate, being careful not to overcarbonate, as always, cooled in the refrigerator, and served the potato beer up that evening. I also did an experiment fermenting potato beer using molds, employing Chinese yeast balls. I steamed 2 pounds, 1 kilogram, potatoes, then mashed them with some of the steaming liquid, cooled them to body temperature, and mixed in 2 crushed Chinese yeast balls. At first, it smelled sweet and there was a bit of liquefaction, but then it developed a strong acetone aroma, which never left it, and I ended up aborting the experiment and discarding it. It was not my first failed experiment, and surely not my last. Beyond hops, beers with other herbs and botanical additives. People in different places and times have incorporated many varying botanical ingredients into their beers. Or rather, the way I imagine it most likely unfolded, people began to incorporate grains into more ancient traditions of fermenting that already incorporated various plants. Brewing emerged as an extension of gathering and then cultivating plants and generating surpluses of grains. The people who brewed early beers were the plant gatherers, women, and in many cultures brewing still remains an exclusive domain of women. In his book Secret Life of Beer, the late beer adventurer Alan Eames recounted an exchange he had with a group of Quechua women brewing chicha after he asked them whether men ever brewed beer. "My question was met with gales of raucous laughter. The women howled. Bent over in hilarity, one replied, "Men can't brew. Chicha made by men only makes gas in the belly. You are a funny man. Beer is women's work." The Quechua are hardly unique in this view. Worldwide, women are recognized as the original brewers of fermented drinks, writes feminist theorist Judy Gron. The brewster, or alewife, was a central figure from Africa to China, South America to Northern Europe. Alan Eames reports, "In hidden, remote places around the world, women still hold close the art of brewing. Praying to their ancient goddesses, the women of non-technological societies continue to pass down to their daughters the secrets of beer. And the secrets of beer are among the many secrets of plants and their associated microbes." Functionally, plant additives in beer have served as flavorings, preservatives, microbial inoculants, and yeast nutrients, as well as medicines and psychotropic agents. German archaeobotanist Carl Ernst Berry lists more than 40 plant species used as beer additives in Europe alone, based on written historical records. "This resulted in a great variety of beers," writes Berry. "Each town and sometimes each brewer had their own specific beer in contrast to the other rather uniform modern beers." Herbalist Stephen Harrod Buhner, author of Sacred and Healing Herbal Beers, documents, and gives recipes for, beers made with heather, mugwort, sage, wild lettuce, nettles, ground ivy, sassafras, horehound, elder, various evergreens, and many plants other than hops. In parts of Europe, local beer flavorings came to be known as gruits or gruets. Buhner explains that gruet typically contained a combination of three mild to moderately narcotic herbs: sweet gale, Myrica gale, also called bog myrtle, yarrow, Acalia millefolium, and wild rosemary, Ledum palustre, also called marsh rosemary, along with additional herbs to produce unique tastes, flavors, and effects, including juniper berries, ginger, caraway seed, coriander, aniseed, nutmeg, and cinnamon. The exact formula for each gruet was, like that for Coca-Cola, proprietary, a closely guarded secret. In the Holy Roman Empire, gruets became the means by which beer was taxed. During the 11th century, the Holy Roman Emperor awarded local monopoly privileges in the production and sale of gruet, the Grutrecht, to dioceses throughout the empire, writes economist Diana Weinert. This was one step among many towards centralizing social control, regulating beers and what could go into them across a vast territory, effectively transferred power from the women who gathered herbs and brewed beer with it to the emergent institutions of empire. Locally distinctive gruet herb and spice mixes became exclusive franchises. In Weinert's analysis, uniqueness of flavor was essential for the clergy's ability to enforce their monopoly privilege and extract rents from beer producers and consumers. Hops, Humulus lupulus, was among the herbs used in some gruets. It was first referred to as a beer herb in writing in the 1150s by St. Hildegard of Bingen, Physica Sacra. Use of hops spread, in part because of the excellent preservative quality of beer brewed with it. And of course, the laws of the Holy Roman Empire did not extend everywhere. The North German Hanseatic cities were not bound by gruet regulation. Using new larger copper brewing kettles, brewers in Hamburg successfully scaled up beer production and began exporting beer made with hops. They pioneered the mass production and distant transport of beer. At one time, the term beer referred only to barley drinks to which hops had been added, while ale might be flavored and preserved with any number of other plants, writes ethnobotanist Dale Pendle. By the 1400s, beers brewed exclusively with hops were widely known and beginning to compete with gruet-brewed beer. Hops, the bigger copper kettles, and the international beer trade they facilitated effectively undermined the existing regulatory regime, concludes Weinert. But another regulatory regime quickly followed. The earliest laws requiring the use of hops, 1434, were broader edicts also regulating beer markets with price setting and entry restrictions. Rather than protecting consumers, the law allowed brewers to collude and charge higher prices at the expense of the consumer. The gruets were controlled by the Holy Roman Empire, and the challenge to the gruet-centered regulatory regime coincided with the schism in that empire remembered in history as the Protestant Reformation. Stephen Harrod Buhner offers a compelling interpretation of how the use of botanical additives in beer came to be played out through this schism. One of the arguments of the Protestants against the Catholic clergy, and indeed against Catholicism, was their self-indulgence in food, drink, and lavish lifestyle, writes Buhner. This behavior was felt to be very un-Christ-like indeed. According to Buhner, the three herbs at the core of most gruets, yarrow, sweet gale, and marsh rosemary, are highly inebriating and stimulating when used in ale, far out of proportion to their individual effects outside of fermentation. Of the bitter herbs besides hops used as admixtures in fermented malt beverage, writes Pindell, many of them are psychoactive. In contrast, hops cause the drinker to become drowsy and they diminish sexual desire, writes Buhner, arguing that hops' ascendancy was encouraged by Protestant judgments about the wild indulgences of the Catholic Church, fueled by aphrodisiac and psychotropic herbs that were commonly found in the church's gruets. Hops beer still had alcohol, but led to somewhat more subdued behavior and eventual torpor. The result was, ultimately, the end of a many thousand years tradition of herbal beer making in Europe, and the narrowing of beer and ale into one limited expression of beer production, that of hopped ales, or what we today call beer. Cultural revivalists are freeing themselves from the shackles of the hops beer monoculture by reinventing herbal brews in a spirit of experimentalism and reclaiming our human legacy of alcoholic beverages as manifestations of plants occurring in infinite variety. Adrienne Jonquil, an herbalist and brewer, sent me a bottle of her incredibly delicious yarrow ale. Adrienne had written to me earlier, wondering about the effects of ale made with plants other than hops to the mind, soul, and body. I think valuable cultural revivalist work asks to be done detailing exactly how fermentation may alter specific actions of various plants. Systematic or not, experiment. Any herb or spice, and for that matter any fruit, edible flower, bark, root, or other plant part that you could add to mead or consume in any other way, you can use to flavor grain-based alcoholic beverages. Distillation. Distillation is a process that concentrates alcohol, or other volatile substances. Only fermentation can create alcohol, and distillation can only concentrate alcohol that has already been fermented. Any type of fermented alcohol may be distilled. The process takes place in an apparatus known as a still. Distillation evaporates and then condenses the fermented alcohol thanks to the different boiling temperatures of different substances. Alcohol boils at 173 degrees Fahrenheit, or 78 degrees Celsius, while water, as we all know, boils at 212 degrees Fahrenheit, or 100 degrees Celsius. So when fermented alcohol, a mixture of alcohol and water, is heated, the vapors contain proportionately more alcohol than the liquid, as does the resulting liquid when the vapors are cooled. With repeated runs through the still, a purer and purer product results. Home distillation of alcohol is illegal in the United States and much of the rest of the world. The typical explanation for this prohibition is that distillation is potentially dangerous, since highly toxic methanol as well as ethanol concentrates in the distillation process. However, methanol has a lower boiling point than ethanol, so the first concentrated liquid that collects in the still, where methanol is concentrated, known to distillers as the heads, is generally discarded. The other explanation for the home distillation ban is that distilled spirits are an important source of tax revenues. Aside from legal constraints, the other impediment to home distillation is the specialized apparatus required. You can buy a still, although in the United States the federal government's Alcohol and Tobacco Tax and Trade Bureau monitors their sale. I was very impressed by the ingenuity of a group of Bhutanese and Nepali immigrants I met in Oakland, California, who improvised a still from common household items to carry on their tradition of distilling a liquor called roxy from chang they fermented from millet. The base of their still was an aluminum steaming pot on a portable burner, filled with the chang they were distilling. Into that pot they suspended a simple ceramic flower pot, with the drainage hole enlarged to allow steam evaporating from the chang to rise. Then they suspended a small bowl with two handles in the flower pot so that steam could rise around it. Finally, they placed a second aluminum steaming pot, this one smaller and filled with cold water, so it fit snugly atop the flower pot. This caused the steam hitting it to condense, and the condensation dripped into the small bowl suspended beneath it. To seal the crevices where the pots met, they wrapped wet handkerchiefs around them to prevent steam from escaping. We drank the smooth, delicious, and potent roxy still warm.